here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 501, the beginning of, I've completed 10 years on the air, starting another series. The way the news breaks every day, there are one or two articles that pertain to past subjects that I've brought up on the air in the past 10 years and the articles I've written. And it's quite nice to see some of these exposés being revealed even at a very late date that confirms some of the outrageous allegations that I've made or that my coworkers have made and other researchers and authors around the country. There's an article in the paper this week, Associated Press story, you might have seen, Scientists Doubt Body that was that of Eva Braun. I've done many broadcasts on Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun, his mistress, who he allegedly married just at the time they were supposed to have died. In 1978, May of 78, on KLRB, I did a broadcast mentioning that August Wilhelm Bartholdy, a cook that was in the kitchen, a double of Adolf Hitler's, that allegedly took the place of the Führer. This article is by Professor Ryder Sognnes, S-O-G-N-N-E-S, from Norway. He's been at UCLA as a dean there for a guest in the School of Dentistry. He said he helped identify the remains of the Nazi dictator Adolf Hitler and that he had doubts about the identity of the woman found near the Berlin bunker where Hitler and Braun reportedly had killed themselves April 30th, 1945. The Nazi officials allegedly had taken their bodies out and doused them with gasoline and set them on fire. He said that the identification of Eva Braun was based on a dental bridge made for her, which the Soviets said they recovered intact from the body, and when the fire burned, the woman's face was burned beyond recognition, and the white plastic teeth were allegedly intact. And this particular dentist had taken the bridge that wasn't found with the body, and he tried to identify it and found out that the very dental technician who made the false teeth told him later, just recently, that they were still in the workshop when Berlin fell, and they never fitted in Eva Braun's mouth, that whatever was found there on the ground wasn't hers, and that Russians then said what they found had later been destroyed. As I say, I've done many broadcasts on whether or not Hitler and Eva Braun did escape and did, in fact, go down to Argentina and Antarctica. I got out several books on the death of Adolf Hitler, and I'm not going to do too much on that tonight. I just wanted to mention that it was in the news again. There's one book called The Death of Adolf Hitler by Lev Bazemensky, and he refers to the William Shire account in the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich that their bones were never found, and it gave rise to rumors that Hitler had survived. All traces were wiped out. There's another book by Alan Bullock on Adolf Hitler that what happened to the ashes of the two bodies has never been found, that they allegedly were disposed of, thrown to the wind, but then open fire will not destroy the human body so completely as to leave no traces and nothing found in the garden. The circumstance of his, in this book he describes of Hitler and Goebbels and their last days together leaves a lot to be questioned about the ashes and Adolf Hitler. He refers to the examination that this author went in Germany after the war to ask about the teeth, in particular anatomical parts of the woman that was supposed to be Eva Braun, the anatomical characteristics of the body. He goes into the age of the woman and the surface of the teeth. And the most important anatomical finding for identification of the person was the gold bridge of the lower jaw and the lower front teeth. There was extensively charred corpse that was found, and there were splinter injuries to the throat and injuries on the lung and to the body. They didn't account for how that happened and pass that off, that maybe in moving the bodies that these injuries came. But it could have been a double who was also injured when they took her and poisoned her and cremated whoever was there. Although, as I say, the cremation, the ashes were never seen and the bodies were never seen. The conclusion of this book, this one book, says that the injuries of Eva Braun weren't inconsistent with what happened in the bunker, but he goes at great length about the identification of the teeth, and now it turns out years later that this, in fact, is not the truth. This investigator went to, as I say, to the person who made the teeth for Eva Braun and got an explanation about the teeth. And now it seems that the particular bridge work they're talking about was not in that bunker. The same week that this story broke, July the 11th, this week, Dr. Walter Langer passed away. Now, he's another author who wrote The Mind of Adolf Hitler. And interestingly enough, in 1943, he wrote for the OSS. He worked for the OSS, which became the CIA, that Hitler would commit suicide. And this reminds me of the book The Black Abductor, the story of Patty Hearst that was written several years before she was abducted. And many other books written by the OSS and then later the CIA of detailed events before they take place. And it's interesting that a man who worked with the OSS, Dr. Walter Langer, becomes the expert on the suicide of Adolf Hitler and wrote it 2 years before it happened. And he wrote it in 1943, the time that the Nazis were going underground and realized they couldn't win the war and would make plans for later. So part of the plans might have included the suicide, because the OSS was working with Hitler's SS, the stormtroopers, for moving them out of Germany and out of the country to South America for protection and for usefulness against a third world war against the Soviet Union later on. I'm not going to do much this evening, as I say, on the death of Hitler or Eva Braun or whether they're alive or not. I did pull out some notes from another book written, is called Who Killed Hitler, that I've done broadcasts on, edited by Herbert Moore and James Barrett. And the foreword is written by the former chief of intelligence officer of the U.S. Army in Berlin. He said, I was assigned to find Adolf Hitler and the body immediately upon the entry of American troops in Berlin, and I can state positively I did not find Hitler, nor did I find his physical remains. I have not been able to find any evidence that the body was burned, and I've been unable to locate any persons who witnessed Hitler's last days in the Reich Chancellery. During my stay in Berlin, I lived with the chief of British intelligence. I shared his knowledge of all known reports regarding Hitler's probable fate, and this would include Eva Braun, who was with him. For this reason, I cannot overstress the fact that I have never been able to find any reliable witness of Hitler's activities after April 22nd. 9 days before the date of the supposed suicide. Under those circumstances, I never stood on what substance you, Trevor Roper, based the official British intelligence report that came out November the 1st, 1945. And furthermore, he wrote it when the Chancellery had not been investigated or opened until December the 12th, 1945. And he describes Hitler's double, who was 54, an individual in physical specifications of the Führer, who occasionally was used for non-speaking public occasions, who was assigned to the Führer's household staff as assistant cook, and never was permitted to show himself outside of the underground kitchen those last days from April, the end of April, until May the 1st, and was never seen again afterwards. So I have many books on the death of Hitler, but I've mentioned them on broadcast before, and I think it's interesting that one of the men who wrote The Mind of Hitler, who wrote about his suicide, worked for the OSS, and the story of Eva Braun's dentures was completely fabricated. The stories about Hitler are important because it is my belief, based upon several hundreds of books, maybe 200 or 300 books I have, that the era never ended, and it is leading us up to what Hitler wanted, which was specifically World War III, to weaken the United States and Great Britain and keep the Germans in South America, Africa, Middle East strong while we fight each other out. Apropos of that, a few news stories you might have seen this week that go along those lines that I watch every day and get a little bit nauseated as I think of the entrenchment of the Nazis, not the neo-Nazis, but the Nazis with OSS and Alan Dulles, from 1943 on up to the present time. The Washington Post had an article Monday, July 6th, George Ball, that old Cold War obsession. And this is what he says. I'll just do a few sentences. John Foster Dulles, he was Secretary of State through the entire Cold War, and Alan Dulles, his brother, was head of the OSS, working with Himmler and the Nazis and planning underground to work with the British against the Soviet Union later on. John Foster Dulles is alive and well and living in the White House, Once again, we hear his passionate charge that the Soviet Union is the Antichrist, threatening civilization with a pernicious document. The Soviets, we are told by President Reagan and Secretary Haig, are responsible for our international troubles, for our political turmoil, for every small Latin American country, for turbulence in the Middle East, for tribal wars in Africa, for terrorism all over the world. Now, once more, we shiver at the idea of Cold War. Diplomacy is for sissies. A resolute America must build bigger and stronger weapons. We must arm any regime, no matter how corrupt or repressive, that shouts anti-communist slogans. I strongly suspect there is a White House directive requiring every administration speech to include a denunciation of evil Soviet communists. Such an attitude is not a policy, but an obsession, grotesquely oversimplified. It is outdated. Whatever the situation 40 years ago, it no longer exists. And it goes on to talk and denounce Haig and Reagan for throwing the Alan Dulles speeches out every time they open their mouths, and everyone in the State Department. The headlines this week, these are just in the past week. One Associated Press story, White House policy on human rights is scrapped as the key to arms sales, and it's about dumping any idea of human rights and arming every dictator who wants weapons. L.A. Times, July the 7th, one-way street to South America. Reagan overtures to the rightist regimes and brings nothing back, no return yet. San Francisco Examiner, Latin American advisors emphasize the military. And it goes into the team in Latin and Central America that were active in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, destabilized and killed Allende in Chile. And it mentions Vernon Walter, who I mentioned on the program last week. Associated Press, July the 11th, lawyer reports torture of Chilean prisoners. They're using electroshock beatings, forcing people to listen while their wives and children are tortured in adjoining rooms. It's going on presently. July the 7th, 28 massacred in El Salvador. They shrug it off. Peasants are slaughtered. There is common talk of dumping them, and there's no attempt to identify them. They're put in common graves. July the 7th, 2nd, rights group says Salvadorians are abusing, and they continue to abuse. They're melting faces off with acid. They're beheading people. They're mutilating their bodies, and they're torturing their victims. July the 4th, Marcos named premier, and the opposition labels the praise by Vice President Bush as ignorant. The opponents to Marcos are locked up. This is the Washington Post. Hundreds of political prisoners in jail. Bush assumes we had a real election. It was false. The election is a farce. Marcos is a dictatorship. July the 4th, Washington Post. West Germans see indication of growing anti-Americanism. They're upset by America. They're even throwing rocks at the great giant arches of the McDonald's hamburgers over there. John J. McCloy, former Allied High Commissioner in post-war Germany, said, I've never been as concerned as I am now about our alliance with Germany. And it goes on to say Germany wants to stay out of the United States-Russia conflict. John J. McCloy was chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank. He was on the Warren Commission. He protected Nazis like George de Morenschild and about 20 other Nazis that worked with Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Washington Post, July 2nd, United States foreign policy worries Mitterrand. The United States and Central American policy, he says people are crying for help and the only one that goes to them is Fidel Castro. His answer to that was to appoint Regis Debray, the former Bolivian assistant to Che Guevara, to help Mitterrand with the Third World. July the 5th, Los Angeles Times, Argentine gripped by severe social problems. The economy has high inflation, joblessness, the junta keeps a strong control. July the 3rd, New York Times, Argentina is putting pressure on the press. The only free press in the newspaper, the only publisher, Manfred Schoenfeld, got out of his car last week and had five teeth knocked out by brass knuckles. New York Times, this last week, Moscow calls the U.S. decision to sell arms to China highly dangerous. So the policy we've used since World War II isn't working in any country. This is just a rundown of a few articles. This isn't a broadcast on world events, just a few. And then our ally this last week, South Korea, says it can leave the North Korea in ashes, and hence it will have a nuclear attack over there. We give them the nuclear bombs. We praise the president of South Korea, who sat at a dinner table and murdered his own appointment. His own president over there was right there doing the murdering. He's entertained in the White House, and we'll get the fallout of his atomic bombs making North Korea ashes. We give him the weapons, we give him the power, we give him the prestige like Marcos. Then we're going to sit back and watch all of this come down. Meanwhile, that crazy administration in Washington, an article, the panel to study the U.S. manpower needs for a global war. They're serious, and you better watch it. Another New York Times article this last week, Weinberger, Secretary of the Defense, urging retaliatory ability. He wants a capacity for a conventional strike of the Soviet Union at any place of their choice, wherever it would give us the pleasure to attack. We should have expansionism. He wants to increase military aid in Egypt, in Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other nations. We should send them weapons and money for military aid and prepare to fight this kind of a war. And it goes on and on. Before we get into other subjects, in that book on the death of Adolf Hitler that I was quoting before, there's a section about Adolf Hitler in the bunker at the very end of the war in 1945 in the spring. And remember, he was supposed to have died in May 1st in 1945, or the end of April. I do not make the claim, this author says, that I can present my readers with every last detail of how intensively and by what channels of an understanding Hitler had with the Anglo-Saxon Western powers. In the memoirs of Hitler, Himmler, the chief of intelligence for Adolf Hitler and of his personal physician, there's ample and varied material, factual and analytical, in their works to give the obvious conclusion that the idea of an anti-Soviet plot matured in widely different circles, and they had direct contact, the Nazis, Himmler, and the German Nazis, with American and English personalities. The idea of the plot was strongly worked out with Himmler's SS leaders and with the United States and British officials. British Foreign Secretary Halifax had a conversation with Hitler in 1937, and later Hitler said he would be delighted with a meeting with Halifax, and he said, "I've always said the English will get under the same eiderdown with me in their politics. They will follow the same guidelines I do to annihilate Bolshevism." Hitler talked about tensions between the Western powers. He thought Western powers and Soviet Union would meet head-on, and he would play for time. And in 1944, Hitler was convinced that England and America would be willing to make a separate peace with Germany. And Hitler's idea was to have a collision between the Western powers and the Soviet Union. And after his conferences with his high officials, he said, "Gentlemen, you will see that I am proved right." They were making arrangements for this as early as 1943, so that's why I'm very suspicious that with Martin Bormann and Himmler and the top officials at Hitler's bunker, and with a cook and double there, and no visible proof that this man was dead, there'd be no reason why he wouldn't continue on where he allegedly has gone, according to a lot of good sources, to watch this come down. Hitler planned, this book says, the Battle of the Bulge at the end of 1944 to maneuver the Western powers into a separate peace with him. And Himmler was allegedly offered Eisenhower, the SS, Hitler's SS, and his armed forces if they would continue the war against Russia. And the Anglo-Americans would enter into an armistice, and they would leave their weapons, and they would do this. And Himmler and his top officials and personnel staff established at the end of the war with Alan Dulles. He was the head of the OSS, and with that great writer who passed away this week, who in 43 was saying Hitler would be committing suicide for the OSS, met with Alan Dulles in Italy and planned with Hitler's approval. And it was written up in Martin Bormann's diary that they would meet. And on February the 6th, 1945, Hitler's agents were meeting with the British and the Americans and Alan Dulles and making arrangements for the war against the Soviet Union. Hitler felt that we would fall into this pattern and beat ourselves up, the Americans and the British, and use the German industrialists, and that's what seems to be happening. Certain people may consider the attempts of the leadership of the Third Reich to establish a political and military alliance with the United States and England as remarkably political foresight on the part of Hitler, Himmler, and Ribbentrop. And this book goes on to the fact that they would do it under an organization of the men such as Adenauer and Alan Dulles, who later created NATO. That's what Alexander Haig was the head of, NATO, N-A-T-O, the Organization of the North Atlantic Pact of agents that would arm against Adolf, with Adolf Hitler's men for the war against Russia. They would fight communism in the post-war years, and the Minister of Propaganda would help them. And this one book on Adolf Hitler said, they are speaking of a third world war. The concept of a third world war is an established term in the Anglo-American press. And when I went back and began to collect books of the period of 1945, 1946, it was indeed an accepted fait accompli that what we're reading about in the papers these days about a possible third world war was written up very much, and there were many, many articles about the possibility or the probability that Hitler and Eva Braun escaped. Another article in the paper this week of interest, the Pope picks a panel to aid in funds crisis. Now, this article describes a financial crisis that the Vatican is bankrupt. The Pope is having a meeting in November of 1971. He called a meeting of 130 cardinals. They had a deficit of $20 million in 1979. $28 million later, and another $30 million, the Vatican has neither confirmed nor denied how much money. The shaky funds of the Vatican are linked to Michael Sindona, who combined money of the Vatican in the Franklin National Bank in New York, among other things, great holdings of the Vatican that were lost. Sindona is now in prison in the United States. This is a United Press article this week, July the 7th. He's in prison in the United States because of the failure of the national bank crisis. He was a financial consultant to the Vatican, 1969 to 1970, and the Franklin National Bank and the Vatican lost their money when the bank collapsed. This is July 1981 that this admission is coming out, and I referred to broadcast November the 9th, 1979. That was broadcast number 414. Where I talked about the links of the finances of the Vatican going broke. There was an article of the deficit of the Los Angeles Times in 1979. The New York Times had another article, but interestingly enough, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times articles, and New York Post refer to the links of Michael Sindona to organized crime to the Gambino family and linking the Vatican money, which is the scandal, to various members of the Carlo Gambino family and the New York crime connections related to Italy. So now, in July 1981, they're talking about the Vatican going broke, but earlier, one of the causes was not only the Franklin National Bank going, but Sindona's tying up this money with organized crime and the Gambino family. There's an article paper this last week, Gambino family is the biggest crime family in the world. It seems to have taken over now as the largest family. Well, no wonder if you tie in the Republican Party and some of the Democrats and the Vatican money and these bank failures that are siphoning money in and out of narcotics combines. Gambino family is A1, and that's the one that Sindona worked with. And Licio Gelli, who's fled Italy, and the entire crime syndicate, Vatican, Gambinos are all one ball of wax that I've done many broadcasts on. As a far right-wing member of the Defense Intelligence Agency, he worked with the Israeli intelligence, and there's an article in the Examiner today, a quotation, this is the fellow that I referred to last week, Sabi Shabtai, who testified before the Senate Committee on Terrorism. And he's come to the conclusion that Muhammad Ali Ajah, the man who shot the Pope, has to be an employee of the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union would be the only persons who would want to shoot the Pope. Of course, it's propaganda. The shooting of the Pope has more to do with his direct links to Michael Sindona, Licio Gelli, and the organized crime syndicate, and the missing money of the Vatican, and the treasurer of the Vatican, who's from Cicero, Illinois, the hometown of organized crime, then it has to do with the Soviet Union even trying to shoot the Pope and get away with it. This is more propaganda that comes out all the time and goes before our Senate hearings. There's a large article in the Village Voice this last week, July 1st to July 8th, by Alexander Cockburn and James Ridgway. I won't have time to go in the whole article this week. I just want to mention that it is available if you go to the library or try to get it. And next week, I'll go into it in detail. The thrust of the article is titled, The CIA, Australia, and the Story of the Nugenhan Bank, a subject I've been covering week after week on these programs. It covers bases that the CIA is overthrew the Labor Party and the Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, in October 1975, and meddled with the affairs of Australia. I noticed that the very week that this story broke in New York City in the Village Voice and the Turple story and Edmund Wilson are breaking in the New York Times, the Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, who was the recipient of the CIA coup in Australia, was entertained in the White House this week. They linked the Nugenhan Bank to world heroin traffic and the Green Berets and the CIA operations. This article goes into the Mayo tribesmen, the Laotians, and the efforts to get them into the Caribbean, which I've talked about, and later to locate them in the Jonestown property in Guyana. They go further and they make connections of the Nugenhan drug trade to President and Mrs. Marcos of the Philippines and the laundered money of the former President Suharto of Indonesia, assisted by the Pahlavi family and the Shah's money of Iran and the narcotics with CIA dictators. For those of you who have listened to these programs week after week or year after year know that I've done individual broadcasts on the Shah of Iran and the narcotics traffic and the effect of the politics of Iran with his sister as bagwoman. I've talked about the money flowing out of the Philippines of the Marcos and their links to the narcotics trade. And this article connects Nugenhan and then Frank Turple and the Seymour Hersh articles of Edwin Wilson and Theodore Shackley and the CIA. It's a very good article because it hits bases and then it touches another base, which again goes into the links of Nugenhan to Jonestown and to the operations down there. And it goes into the bauxite cartel. And on various broadcasts, I've talked about the melon interest and the bauxite. And this goes into the financial arrangement of bauxite in Australia and the monopoly and the use of bauxite for aluminum, controlling the world aluminum. And I've said that the Nugenhan Bank funded, I believe the money went to London and Germany and then back down to Guyana to fund Jonestown for the CIA. So I will do more on this Village Voice, but it is covering a lot of bases. And I want to bring it up because when I throw these names out or the activities of the Shah and his sister and the drug dealing and these various operations, there are major newspapers around the country covering these stories, but you have to take 10 or 20 papers or more a day or a week or listen to these broadcasts to know that the pieces of the puzzle are coming together. There's another long article I want to spend time with you next week on in the Los Angeles Times about a David Murdoch. He hasn't been written up much. It was just an article in 1979 in Fortune magazine. This is a man who has $500 million. He's similar to Howard Hughes and Daniel Ludwig in that everything he has is totally owned. He has a Los Angeles-based operation. He's the power behind Mike Curb. He recently raised $1 million for the Republican Party in California. He's has a company called Stair & Company London Antiques. He's a very close associate of John Connolly. He hired in 1979 Robert Haldeman to be vice president of one of his companies. And I'm going into the links of David Murdoch to the assassination teams that are in power that I've been talking about week after week. There is a combine here of John Connolly, Mike Curb, Robert Haldeman, unknown money from private corporations. He's operating in California, and I think that he hits a lot of bases of Watergate, of what's going on around the country, and possibly the John Hinckley family. He also funded Ed Davis's campaign in California to become the senator in California. And in a week or so, I'll go into the links again, the Glass House tapes and the Tackwood allegations of Ed Davis with the secret team of Watergate that work with Haldeman and the people that David Murdoch works with. This may be one of those parts of, if it's a centipede or what, one of those legs of the assassination group. Unlimited money, millions behind politicians. The politicians are tapped in to past political assassinations that have never been investigated. We'll take a one-minute break before we get back some of the headlines of the week I want to run down with you, and then I'll come back and continue on those.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussels.